Accession number 28361, reel 24.
General Julian Thompson, reel 24. Think that your sergeant, your mortar sergeant, telling you what the American officer had said.
Well, he came up to me and said, this chap said to me, when we finish this firing, we'll come over to you and we'll have a cook up and smoke some pot. And he said, you won't do anything of the kind, and if you try, and I shall punch you on the nose. And I had visions of a colour sergeant hitting an American captain. Anyway, this chap withdrew and obviously didn't want to get in job. But that was the sort of thing that went on. Individually, there were many officers and NCOs in the Marines, and I knew them best, who were absolutely first class, but they were completely undermined by this malaise and this dreadful lack of morale. Of course, they did pull themselves up out of this later by taking draconian measures against drug pushers and drug takers and being absolutely ruthless in their discipline, and backed up NCOs who took charge, and they brought themselves round, and I think they're in very good nick now as a result, and I think I take my hat off to the way they did it, actually.
Weren't they also concerned that time by poor recruiting?
They were concerned by poor recruiting because they had changed from a conscript army and marines to a regular.
Then they
haven't taken anybody they could get. So you have this terrible situation where the public in America regards the services as being pretty useless because of their performance in either useless or terrible because of all the things they had allegedly and indeed had done in Vietnam. So you're trying to recruit from a totally cynical bunch of people. And it took a very long time. Take the Marines again, who I know best as an example. Eventually, the way they got round it was by being absolutely ruthless and not taking people. And usually, they would only take high school graduates. They got round to that. And they said, even if we're short, we'd rather have a few good men, was their cry, than a bunch of no-hopers in order to fill the quota. The other thing, the American Marines, of course, had screwed themselves over Vietnam, was that in order, they doubled in size. And what they actually did, their reaction to get their officers, was to commission most of their non-commissioned officers and warrant officers. So they stripped out the backbone of their organization overnight. And it was a disaster. And I think they learned from that you don't just double in size because it's good for promotion, because it is good for promotion, but you also completely wreck your own structure. If you do it too quickly, you dilute the quality. And they had big racial problems too, because I can remember an exercise, again when I was a brigade major, the Sapper squadron commander, we were at that stage running the exercise, we were umpiring it, was going to go with an American battalion. And at one stage he found himself being followed by all the black men in the battalion, and he thought he was going to be taken around the corner and thumped. So he sort of rather nervously asked this chap, why they were following him. And they said, well, we reckon that you'll be able to find the way to the objective rather better than our own officers. And the battalion had literally split on racial lines.
And your officer had attracted the support of the...
Yeah. And indeed he was a thoroughly switched on chap. And I imagine he did get them objective. But that was the sort of thing you came across all the time.
What sort of form would one of the exercises in Thrace take? Shall we take Thrace
Again, one went through this sort of minuet. What would happen? The threat would be built up that something was going to... So we've got to have to get there first to do I can't remember what they were called. And there was a special name for them.
Preventive deployment?
It was a deterrent deployment.
Deterrent deployment.
So you landed in a sort of warlike posture in order to demonstrate how clever you were at doing your landing and how professional you were. And then you went ashore and then did cross-training with the people, the Greeks or Turks or whoever was there, and the other people, your allies, Americans, Italians, and so forth. And then what would often happen would be that they would want to do another landing somewhere else. So you then had this withdrawal back to the shipping, which was slightly bedeviled by one factor, as far as the Americans were concerned, who had an obsession that there was some kind of pest or snail that lurked on the shores of the Mediterranean that must never be taken back to the United States. And so all the vehicles had to be washed down before they went back on board their ships.
The anti-gastropod measures.
More or less, yes, it was. It was. I think that's what it was, anyway. But they all had to be washed down with fresh water. So the withdrawal tended to be a bit of, a minuet, because all the vehicles had to be washed theirs. We didn't care about ours. Unless we were putting them on American ships, which we very rarely did. And then you then went and landed somewhere else. And then at the end of that landing, you had a battle of some kind.
You wouldn't have an advanced contact inland after the first landing.
Well, you might do. You might go from being, doing all these cross-training larks to then doing a battle. But more often, because the Americans tended to want another landing, so they wanted to get in as many landings as they could in an exercise, you did this administrative backload and then went and did another landing somewhere else.
In the course of these operations, you discussed the quality of the American Marines at that time, which for certain reasons was low. What sort of impression did you get of the skills and capabilities and quality of the Turks?
The Turks we regarded as with great respect. They were pretty, their kit was pretty antiquated. I think they were still wearing sort of British World War I helmets, those sort of, flat hats.
The medieval looking.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong, but I do have visions of Turkish soldiers dressed like that. And their equipment was old, but they were tough. You got the impression they would not be a pushover. They would fight hard. Their discipline was very high. You never got incidents of ill discipline, and they were cheerful, sort of get on with it types.
Did you get on well with them when you had to cooperate with them? Were they easy to work with?
Yes, they were a bit rigid.
Rigid.
And terribly worried about security all the time.
You mentioned the maps.
And maps were top secret. Just to illustrate the sort of paranoia, we used to, when we got issue with maps in the headquarters, we'd cut them to fit our boards. And one of the particular exercises we had to do involved quite a long advance into Turkish Straits, and then we're talking about 70 or 80 miles. So we invented a sort of special roller map for the headquarters, which consisted of a huge sort of roll of lavatory paper made out of maps, as it were, covering that distance. And to do that, we had to cut them all up. And then they said, hand them back. So we had to invent a situation which was totally bogus, where one of the trailers carrying all the maps had sunk.
So you lost on exercise.
Lost on exercise. They then demanded to know where. So we then said, we gave them we knew perfectly where they wouldn't find it, because it didn't happen. So we said, it was grid reference, whatever it was, offshore. And they sent divers down to find it, because they couldn't find it, because it never sunk there in the first place. But we had to spend, 6 months lying and making up reasons for not being able to return these maps. And the reason they were top secret was not because they were frightened the Russians would get their hands on them. They were frightened the Greeks would get their hands on them.
Presumably, since they didn't find them, they probably thought the Greeks had.
Probably.
Greek divers have beaten them to it.
Quite.
You could have started a war.
Yes, indeed.
What about the Greeks? How did you assess them?
They were quite sort of hardy, quite tough. They're Greek Marines. They were.
You mean physically tough?
Physically tough.
Mentally tough too?
I didn't get the impression they put up particularly. Their kit, of course, was absolutely ancient. They were using Second World War LSTs and things like that. And they had M48 tanks. They would have fought pretty hard in defence of Greece. There's no doubt about it. Whether they would have fought terribly hard on someone else's territory for NATO, I don't know.
That's another matter, isn't it?
That's another matter.
Motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Italians, you said they were chocolate soldiers.
Yes, they were completely useless, I think. They were much more worried about whether the rations were going to arrive and their food and things like that. I mean, I remember this exercise with a Bersaglieri and armoured battalion in Sardinia, and I went out to do a recce, and the colonel who commanded this battle group was there, and I showed him through my interpreter, who didn't speak any English, my scheme for the exercise, my sort of program of what we were going to do in outline. And he looked at me and said, I see there's no time for lunch. So I said, no, you know, you don't have time for lunch. He said, oh, no, we can't do that. And then I see we're fighting at night. The night is for lovemaking, not for fighting, you know. I mean, he did say that. And he was very upset that we were going to sort of operate on a 24-hour-a-day basis for 5 days. And on the first day, they did play the game and didn't have lunch. On the second day, I remember that they were in the middle of a big counterattack, this mechanized infantry battalion in the Bersaglieri. And they just stopped on the objective and uprolled the food wagons, and they all piled out and got in a queue and started having their lunch in the middle of a counterattack. I couldn't care less. You know, lunch was more important.
Did you ever have lunch with them?
No.
You didn't?
No.
You can't comment on the quality of the cuisine?
No, I don't think the cuisine was all that good. I mean, I didn't lunch with them on the basis that I wasn't going to.
And then you mentioned the Legion.
They were absolutely fantastic. They were really brilliant soldiers. They were a real challenge, actually. I mean, they were the sort of soldiers that you just always want to have on your side, and really terrific. When they were on the other side, of course, on this particular exercise,
they were playing enemy.
They were playing enemy. Yeah. Mm. They were fantastic, brilliant soldiers, well officered, by highly professional chaps.
And what were they doing? Were they just holding defensive positions? Were they counterattacking?
Well, no, this particular exercise was a pretty small scale one. We again were running it in that it was one of our commandos versus their battalion or their regiment.
Was this a national exercise?
It was a national exercise. It wasn't NATO.
Not a NATO.
No, it was a national exercise, and it was mainly a sort of counterinsurgency guerrilla type exercise where, and I can't remember the exact scenario, but it was we were reinforcing this mythical country that was having problems with internal guerrillas. It was really based sort of very largely on sort of Algeria, really.
And they were playing the guerrillas.
They were playing the guerrillas, yeah.
Well, they would have been particularly well adapted to that.
They were, yeah.
Role,
yeah.
And
they had a great sense of humour because. The helicopters inevitably ours, or you know, big jokers, they always land people in the wrong place, and they landed an anti-tank gun in the middle of what was actually a sort of enemy base camp by mistake because their map reading was so bloody awful.
A hot LZ.
So that instantly, I mean, within hours, a sort of postcard appeared in the commander's headquarters, which had come via the umpires, with a picture of an anti-tank gun in Lambert headquarters, and it said, please land some men so we can shoot them with our own anti-tank gun.
How did you liaise with them on those exercises?
Well, we had
exercise headquarters of some sort.
We were the exercise headquarters, you see.
Yes.
So
presumably had an LO.
We had LOs, and yes. We had chaps who were French speakers, chaps who were French interpreters on loan to us to talk to them, and we sort of spoke schoolboy French to them, and of course we'd recorded this exercise, so we'd visited them beforehand and made our sort of numbers with all the various people we were going to play with, so we got to know them quite well.
Did any of them speak English? Were they
not much. And even if they did, they tended not to.
Were you on an exercise ground as such, or were you going over private land?
It was both, actually. One of their training areas, but we expanded right out into the into the terrain, up into the mountains.
In a Mackie.
And it was rather again their humour. They were totally relaxed about things. You know, they never got into a panic about things. Mm. And to illustrate with the story, one young officer, Royal Marine young officer, decided to set up a block in a tunnel where the railway ran, and he thought that railway was a sort of disused railway a la post beaching in England, because there weren't any trains running on it. Well, it happened to be a Sunday, there's a reason. Anyway, he set up a block, built a wall across the railway line in the tunnel, Which was not meant to be against the trains, but it was to be part of a sort of, I don't know, what was in his head, what was rotating around his mind when he did this thing. And a train came across and was nearly derailed by this wall, you see. The French didn't turn a hair. You can imagine the sort of panic there would be in this country, wouldn't you? They sort of ministered with a bugger. I mean, they just laughed. They thought it was hugely funny and instantly named this officer, nicknamed him Monsieur Le Train or something like that, which was the sort of thing they did, that whenever an officer screwed up, he'd be given the nickname of his latest nonsense in the French Legion, you see. They just thought it was hugely funny. Pas de problème was their motto.
Things will arrange themselves.
Things will arrange themselves.
What about the soldiers? I mean, what were their... Did you come across the
Legion
troopers?
Yes. Oh, yes. They were all nationalities. There were some Brits who did speak English. They were very impressive. For example... because we were on very light scales, we didn't take any vehicles. We had a few vehicles. We flew in by C-130, you see. They provided a staff car for my brigade commander, and I got there first to set the exercise up, and then went to meet him at the airport in the staff car, which they had loaned, with a Legion driver. And on the way back, the Legionnaire said to me, and both Pat Ovens and I spoke schoolboy French, you know, would le général, because they always refer to a brigadier as a general, you see. And they had two stars on the vehicle, of course.
Of course.
Like to have supper on the way back. So we said, yes. So he said, give it to me. And he went into a very nice sort of mountain in the hills restaurant. Provide the best table you have in the room and place for the general, and the best meal, and make certain the wine's okay. This is a corporal talking to the restaurant owner. I couldn't visualize even the most sparky British corporal, you know, taking charge of a restaurant quite in that sort of way. And then he went outside and sat in the car. And then when we got back to our camp, I said, it was quite late, and he had to be on duty the next morning. I said, well, you can either drive back home, back to your barracks, or we'll find some way to sleep. He said, I'll sleep in the vehicle. Just crashed out in the back seat. No fuss, no pas de problème. Very impressive.
You mentioned the brigade headquarters. When you were in the field, what did you actually have in the brigade headquarters? Who was there, and what furniture and equipment did you have in order to conduct the business,
right,
running the brigade?
We had a number of vehicles which were fitted for radio, FFRs. And then we had a CP tent. And eventually, we invented a system which did not exist when I was first took over. Well, we had two headquarters. One replicated the other. So we could set up, and this was really against being DF'd by the Soviet, you know, by Warsaw Pact. We reckon they'd find us very quickly.
And so we had Sigint.
Through Sigint. Yeah. And therefore, we had to move a lot in order not to be hit. And so we eventually set up a system of having two headquarters. Originally, when I arrived, we had a system of moving through a thing called step-up, where you had a sort of amoeba that you detached from yourself, which took control while you moved to another place.
Foot on the ground.
Or foot on the ground. But we reckoned better than having that. And that was tended not to be as efficient as the actual main headquarters. So while the move was taking place, the command tended to be degraded. So I eventually, with my team, after about a year, having done a lot of exercises, invented a system where you had two duplicate headquarters.
Were these identical?
Identical.
Mm. So.
And one was dormant and one was open. And when the open one was working, the dormant one moved to another place. Yeah. And then you just said, move. And all the guys moved to that. Mind you, kept that stayed open until you said, we're here, come and join us.
Yeah.
And then immediately that closed, that moved to another place. So we used to move the headquarters three or four times a day in order to get round this business of being DF'd by the enemy.
Okay, let's call them then, shall we, HQA and HQB.
Yeah.
Who would be an HQA?
Well, HQA suppose that's the active headquarters, would be me and the G3 ops, all the staff, the brigade commander, signalers. And then in HQB, there'd be one staff officer with signalers. But they wouldn't be transmitting. They'd be quiet.
Yeah. Would this be the staff captain?
It would probably be. It could be a staff captain. But it was usually someone pretty junior, because we didn't have the number of people to detach someone reasonably senior to that. What we would have done in wartime, and we practiced in peace, was take reservists to bump up our staff levels so that we could have a much more bumped up lot of guys sitting in the dormant headquarters. And we used to use that expression, dormant and active headquarters. And obviously we couldn't afford the kit to replicate them exactly. Bits had to join the dormant headquarters from the active headquarters in order to bring it up to strength. It was again peacetime treasury, lack of kit and so forth, didn't allow us to have them absolutely replicated in terms of radios, vehicles and people. But we reckoned that we want to try and achieve that. Because we were not mechanized and therefore couldn't move the headquarters sitting in the back of a warrior operating as you went, on the move we were not as effective as we were when we were static, because we were not a mechanized headquarters, you see.
So your FFRs, were they Land Rover?
Yeah.
I mean, the other way of doing it is to have a box body four-tonner of some sort, isn't it?
Well, we didn't want to do that, because you can't lift a box body four-tonner under a helicopter.
So it's air portability.
It was heliportability.
Heliportability.
The whole headquarters was heliportable.
Right.
Because the helicopters at the time were the Wessex, we didn't have Sea Kings. So it had to be a Wessex lift. So we had lightweight Land Rovers. Yeah. There's not much room in the back of a lightweight Land Rover.
Will this be cut down?
You remember the little cut-down lightweight Land Rovers with a funny sort of sloping bonnet?
Like the Mini Moke.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't that. It was a Land Rover in the sense you had seats in the front and then you had the parallel seats at the back, but you could only cram in four people in the back, literally sitting like this.
Yes.
There was no room for mat boards or anything like that.
Yes.
And of course, when they were lifted in, they were stripped down.
Yeah.
So there was no canopy.
Nothing.
So you operated, and then we'd also often land the vehicles over a beach, so they were waterproofed. Mm. So you were landing a trailer load of stuff that had to go through the water. Mm. And you were operating in that much water, so the trailer was floating behind the Land Rover, and it had to be contained in waterproof bags. So everything was terribly lightweight.
But wirelesses weren't lightweight in those days, were
they?
No,
wirelesses
were still quite heavy.
The wires were heavy, but they were, again, that was another reason. In the FFRs, they were in these waterproof bags in the Land Rover.
Because these were just the old battery-driven.
Yeah, they were the old battery-driven. The old battery-driven. I can't remember what sets they were, but they were the Klansman sets, the Klansman generation, because we got Klansman quite early. We had Klansman.
Klansman was lighter, wasn't it, than the earlier?
Yeah, but even then, your long-range sets were vehicle-borne.
Yes.
And many of them were HF, not VHF. Yeah.
Were they the sort of sets that you had to put onto a sort of pierced metal frame in the back?
Yeah. You had a cage. They were called a cage. They went in a cage. On the back.
With long whip aerial.
With long whip aerials, yeah. Which were often on the bonnet, on the mudguard.
Tied down to the mudguard.
No, quite often they were mounted on the mudguard. There was a sort of rubber blob about that size on the mudguard with an aerial sticking up.
Yeah. That makes it all very distinctive, doesn't it? It's easy to identify.
Well, I mean, one of the things we took a great pride in was our camouflage and our defence. And we exercised our camouflage again and again and again and again, and we were bloody good at it, actually.
How do you
We could even camouflage, let me tell you how good we were at it, when it came to the Falklands, we could even camouflage our headquarters on a bare-ass piece of terrain where there was apparently nothing, so that people flying in couldn't find it.
Oh.
I mean, chaps would come to visit and say, where the bloody hell's the headquarters?
What did they think it was? Did you camouflage it as a rock or something of that sort?
It depended where you were. In Greek and Turkish Thrace, there's quite a lot of forest.
Mm.
So you'd go into a forest. Or you'd, if you were on a really bare-ass piece, you'd try and disguise yourself as you know, a piece of scrubland or among houses, it was easy. You just drove the vehicles into the buildings.
Yeah, I mean,
so we were very adaptable, and that was the advantage of having. When I became brigade commander, this is going a hell of a long way, because we had heavier helicopters and bigger vehicles, we eventually got to a vehicle-borne headquarters, which I can come to when I come to that bit. But when I was brigade major, we were heli and landing craft portable, so we had to be very light. Mm. And so there was no advantage in having what many brigades at the time had, which was a sort of complex. We backed all the vehicles into a bloody great tent, because that wasn't flexible enough, because we were always stuck with that sort of, how should I call it, that, you know the one I mean, where you have a sort of, you have a complex of tents which go out to the backs of vehicles,
yes,
which radiate out, penthouses.
It's like a star shape.
Yeah, well, yes. There's no advantage in having that where we were working, because it wasn't flexible enough. What we had was a 12 by 12 CP, in fact, Naomi got to two 12 by 12s added together, which you then put up, and then where you put the vehicles depended on the ground.
Where you could hide them.
Where you could hide them. And you know, I can remember the first exercise we did, the brigade commander came quite rightly, booted me up the arse, because we'd laid it out in a very sort of stylized way, which didn't fit with the place we were in.
Symmetrical.
It was too symmetrical. Mm.
You've got to make it random.
You've got to make it random.
Fit in with nature.
And fit in with what's around, and we got bloody good at that. Yeah.
What was in the tent then? Do you have a table in the tent?
Yeah, we had several things. We had two ends to the tent.
Yes.
There was my end, the ops end, where you had a map on the wall on a sort of easel.
Yeah.
And that was, and you had some chairs around it, and I and the commander would sometimes sit and look at it, and that was maintained, and the chaps ran that.
Folding canvas chairs.
Yeah.
And an easel. Was the easel purpose made?
Yes, it was purpose made, and it sort of went up against the wall of the tent.
Did you have Chinagraph?
Chinagraph and talc.
Talc and Chinagraph.
Yeah, talc and Chinagraph. Right. And that was run by the G3 ops. I mean, that was his baby.
Yeah.
And then at the other end, you then had the Supporting Arms Coordination Centre table, which is a flat table.
Yes.
Which was the master, the master of that was the regimental commander of the supporting artillery. And the air support guys... The light aircraft, light helicopters and support helicopters, because they were having to coordinate the movement of air in and out of the area to make sure they didn't shoot themselves down or get shot down, etc. So I must go and have a pee. Can I just nip out? Can we stop?
You were saying the coordination table was there to make sure that the artillery and the armour, not the armour, the aircraft and the helicopters were all operating in a way that prevented them from coming into conflict with each other.
That's right, and also naval gunfire, of course.
And naval gunfire
as
well.
If you were within range of naval gunfire. Yeah. And in a way, too much of a meal was made of it.
What, of the coordination?
Of the coordination, which was a hangover from the Far East.
Yes.
And eventually, we simplified it because the regimental commander said this is absolute nonsense. With eyeball control, i.e. FOOs, and eyeball FACs, you can simplify it by making certain the control is at the far end and all you're doing at the back end is monitoring. And he then came up with the other point, which is again very relevant, as far as helicopters are concerned. As long as helicopters fly low... And as long as they don't fly actually over a gun position, and as long as they don't fly over the target, they won't get hit. Because the very nature of artillery and mortar fire is that, so they can go under it. And again, that simplifies it. So you don't then get this terrible business that we originally had, which was very much left over from the Americans, and how they went on doing it while I worked with them. Was that if any sort of helicopters or aeroplanes came into the air, everything stopped.
Well, the problem is that it takes some nerve to fly under the telegraph wires.
That's right. Well, they didn't have to fly under the telegraph wires. They just had to fly low. I mean, you know, they could fly at 500 feet when you think of the trajectory of an artillery shell. And that's why I said if you don't fly over the gun position, and you don't fly over the target, you can fly anywhere else you like because you're not going to get hit. And these sort of startling, blinding glimpses of the obvious had eluded people up to this stage. Mm. But you still had it there, because it would control